This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. Filming, taping, just taping, I guess, although that's not the real word. Recording at an unusual time for us. It's afternoon, Rick. How are you doing this afternoon?
Yeah, this is the second afternoon one we've done recently. Yeah, it's tea time. I'm drinking, I don't know, Darjeeling or some weird stuff that I found downstairs. And yeah, afternoon. Woo-hoo! Let's go.
I'm having a very late lunch. How long does falafel stay good, you think?
Oh, you got to eat it faster. It's just, no, I don't think. I mean, I think it's fine to eat. It just, you know, it's best to eat them when they're hot.
I reheated it. It's like 10 days old. Should be fine. I'm a little bit of a cowboy when it comes to leftovers. Anybody who's ever taken a food safety class as part of a restaurant just cringes when they see what I do. My theory is if it doesn't make me gag, it's good to go. But, you know, honestly, living in Florida, you get used to just kind of taking things hardcore when you need to. Right?
Is that the segue?
It's our segue. It was so subtle. So very subtle. By the way, completely unrelated, we have a guest. And Rick, this guest is your guest. So do you want to
I'm gonna read some of the stuff off his bio from The Lightner because it's pretty awesome. It said Matt Keen is an award-winning journalist, record-setting adventurer, and conservation photographer based in St. Augustine, Florida. His work spans environmental journalism, filmmaking, and photography with a focus on protecting fragile ecosystems, especially in his home state. I think I first became aware of Matt. Didn't you do this great journey up the Ocklawaha that you did the whole length of it in this big kayak?
I did. Yeah, I did. Thank you first, Rick and Kathy, for having me on the program today. It's great to be able to talk to you about this upcoming exhibit. So I paddled the entire length of the Ocklawaha as sort of a follow-up to a 310-mile paddle of the St. Johns River. And then did a few documentaries off of that. One of them, which was called River Be Damned, which was a 17-minute long, short documentary. And then, about a year and a half later, Lost Springs, which follows the artist Margaret Tolbert and, a group of activists, historians, scientists that are all experiencing the Ocklawaha River during one of its drawdowns.
So did you paddle Rodman Pool as part of that?
I did, yeah. And there are very few places that I have paddled in throughout the state that have left the sort of visceral experience that I had paddling through Rodman, through the pool. I was fortunate to paddle it at the tail end of a drawdown. So the gates had already sort of closed back down and the water was beginning to fill up. And we emerged out of the floodplain forest and began our paddle the length of the pool all the way to the dam. And we just were winding through a cemetery of, you know, chopped off trees that were paddling. When you're paddling, these trunks are rising up above you, above your shoulders and above your head. And they were all kind of at that same level. It was very visceral. It was a really, you know, just, there were few words to kind of be able to capture what that experience was like. And when I finished that trip, you know, when we hit Rodman Dam, we had to portage. I was paddling with Ryan Canty, who's paddled the St. Johns and the Ocklawaha with me. When we reached Rodman Dam, we had to portage our kayaks, which means we had to pick them up, carry them over the earthen berm, and then down to the water on the other side and launch them back into the lower Ocklawaha River. So It was just a it was a very different type of paddle from other rivers that I've been on in the state, and it made me really want to learn more about its history and why it was that way.
It's you know, we had Margaret Spontak on the show a few weeks ago, and it's just absurd that the thing still exists. There's really no reason for it. It's kind of one of our things, and we're looking forward to a drawdown. Have you heard anything new about a drawdown?
I have not. No, I don't have any updates, unfortunately. It's, I will, I can guarantee that I will rearrange whatever plans I have during the 4 to 6 months that the river returns to that state, hopefully longer, if possible. It's always possible. But yeah, I will make every intention I can to get back over there. It's a very special place to experience when it's in the historic river channel.
How did you, we're gonna switch now. How did you get to where you are now doing this? Well, explain the work that's gonna be in your show in the Lightner. I guess
Yeah,
that's a
let's
good
talk
way to.
about the show though, because this is people might be listening to this after the show is closed. So let's give the dates for the show too.
So the exhibit opens Friday, October 3rd, which is the first Friday art walk in downtown St. Augustine. So a lot of art galleries participate in that. And this will be part of that with the Leitner Museum, which is right in downtown St. Augustine. And it'll run until January 18th. So people will have an opportunity to see it through the entire Knights of Lights season as it
Oh,
is
cool.
St. Augustine. And yeah, they'll be able to see it up until mid-January. The exhibit itself is a collection of photographs that I've made over the last 4 years that are photographs from all over the state of Florida, and then even there's going to be a plate in there that's from the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia. When I say make these photographs, I'm using a process that was popularized in the 1850s and was the most widely commercially used process of photography up until about the 1890s, early 1900s. It's called wet plate photography, and I use a camera from the early 1900s
Is
when
that the
I'm.
one we can see behind you right now?
That is one of them. With this process, I have to use basically the size camera for the size photograph that I want to make, because there's no editing to these photos. They are coming. It is the light that is coming straight through the lens, and that's hitting the plate of film on the back of the camera. And so the photographs that I make, through identifying kind of how long an exposure should be, and variables with my chemistry, I am able to take photographs of these areas using a process that's 170 years old now. I use basically the same recipes that they used back in the 19th century. I mix all of my own chemistry for it. I use, just like with this camera, I use a lot of equipment that is antiques, essentially. But for me, they're still working tools. And then for the things that I can't find, oftentimes I end up having to make them. So in order to make certain lenses fit on some of these cameras, I have to fashion new lens boards that will allow me to attach a specific lens to a specific camera.
Modern lenses or old lenses then?
That's a great question. I use a variety of lenses. I use my kind of working horse lenses from the 1960s, and I use it for a lot of my portraiture work, and I use it for a lot of landscapes. But I have two lenses that are from the 1860s. One of them is a Petzval design lens, which has been popularized with the really kind of swirly bokeh that comes around the image. And then the other is the is a much wide, more of a wide angle lens, but it's one of the earliest designs of that type of lens from that period. So I have a lens that was an aerial reconnaissance lens. So it was used in planes to take basically pre-satellite photographs that I use as a telephoto lens. So if I'm photographing the lighthouse, for instance, that's the lens that I use. So
Wow.
it's very it is very, very humbling and rewarding to be able to use this equipment still. You know, I've taken apart, for instance, those lenses from the 19th century. I've taken the elements of them apart, and you can still see pencil writing on the glass from when it was first, you know, kind of checked off and polished. So there's an element of history that I feel is kind of tangible with the process. And for me, it's really special to be able to keep doing it.
I want to talk about the photography for a minute because I'm listening to you talk and you're talking about lenses and cameras from the 19th century. And I'm thinking my Canon D7000, I imagine at one point will be not as widely studied, but cameras like it, the DSLRs, will be like, oh, these quaint things from the 20th century, and I'm recreating them. And also, obviously, our listeners can't see you. Either men just age better than women, or you used a lot more sunscreen than I did, but I don't think you're my age. I don't know if you're old enough to have taken actual film photography classes in high school. So
So,
I'm curious, really. Did you,
or
how,
college.
or yeah, college, I couldn't take them because it used to be a requirement that you had to pass a 2D drawing class to take photography. And I couldn't, I was too intimidated to even try. I think I took one drawing class and dropped out because I'm like, I can't draw a bowl of fruit. I just want to take pictures.
a great questions to so I am 40, so my first camera that I can recall was a Polaroid camera that I wore around my neck and would take, you know, instant disposable pictures of. But I had a SLR growing up. You know, I was kind of in that period of time where everything was transitioning to digital, and I shot with film, mostly 35 millimeter, all the way up through high school. But I was beginning to look at digital cameras, and I graduated high school in 2003, and I could say within 2 years I was probably shooting digital for any photographs I took up until about 9 years ago, and that's when I started shooting film again, particularly large format cameras.
I assume you're familiar with Clyde Butcher.
Absolutely.
I don't know if it's still up in his gallery down in Big Cypress, but he had in there, he had for a long time kind of a, I don't want to call it a screed because I don't want to make it sound like it was that angry, but he had a whole big explanation about how he was really fighting digital. And I know a lot of people say, oh, that's so quaint. You can do this or that with digital. But there is something, as somebody who grew up with film, my first camera was a Minolta. You know, I got my first digital camera 2003. I got a Kodak EasyShare because the job I was doing as a reporter required I get a digital camera, and I got an $80 digital camera, which was a lot for 2003. You know, it was cheap though for digital. I think there's something about capturing the way light and film react. I think there's something you can do. You know, and Rick, of course, he's a graphic designer in addition to being a writer and a very talented podcast host. But I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of things you can do in Lightroom or Photoshop or any number of programs. But I don't think you can recreate the way film and light work together. I just think there's something about the chemical reaction that you can simulate. And I don't know, maybe to people who are 20, they won't see a difference. But to me, it's the difference between listening to an MP3 and a piece of vinyl.
In my opinion, beautifully said. I agree with a lot of what you're saying. And kind of speaking to that, what really first pulled me back to shooting film was actually I was really looking into resolution of cameras, and I was looking to see where film fell in comparing it to some of the modern digital cameras and the images that you're able to get out of them now. Because after I graduated high school, my work with photography and videography was all digital. And so I learned those tools and have learned to use those tools as effectively to, to relay messages and tell stories as I can. But for my personal projects, I was starting to look at how I could get the best fidelity out of an image and get an image that just that really had captured a level of detail in it that I was looking for, in particular in landscapes. So I picked up a large format camera. I traded three lenses for a 4x5 camera and 20 film holders at a camera swap in Orlando. And I started shooting 4x5 film and developing it in my bathroom. And then I started picking up my old 35 millimeter cameras that I had and getting cameras from family that they still happen to have in, in closets. And I started shooting with those. And I did notice this just this entire experience that is captured, that while I may have had a certain level of enjoyment taking a digital camera out and shooting, shooting different perspectives and just using my eye for a period of time, there was something to both the continued relationship that you have with film when it comes to bringing it and either taking it to a developer or developing it yourself. There is still something that you're working with when you're figuring out the print that you're looking to have from it. And so, and then for me, a big part of it was just the hands-on nature with digital. In addition to this, I work full-time for the St. Johns County School District doing video production, and I've been with them for more than 10 years, and I love telling stories through video, but working behind a digital screen and editing on a digital computer didn't have the same tactile relationship that I have when I'm shooting with the large format cameras, when I'm, really like, it's a hands-on process, and that just pulled me right into it.
I think there's a connection, especially when we talk about Florida nature photography, or I guess any nature photography, but this is not the any spectacular, it's the Florida spectacular. So I'm going to just say Florida nature photography. For film, I am sure photojournalists, like people who are going to war zones, who are paparazzi, who are taking pictures of sports, all those types of photographers, digital is a blessing. And digital has been wonderful for me. But when you are stopping to shoot with film, and more so with the large format camera, my God, you have to think more about what exactly you want, because there is, unfortunately, with a lot of photographers, this we'll fix it in post mentality. And with film, you do not. And I really think that the pictures I took with my film camera, I became a good photographer with a digital camera because I could make the mistakes. But a nature photographer, I mean, especially talking about going to Florida with the massive, along a river. I mean, you talked about it's this primeval world where you get the trunks of the cypress trees and they're bigger than you. And you really have to think about what you want to take and how the light's going to hit. I mean, there's so much more connection to me. And you learn so much about the photographer with film. Whereas with digital, I don't think you learn as much about the photographer because what you're seeing with your pictures is this is what Matt Keane really wanted to look at. This is what it's just such a, and a lot of it does have to do with the physics of film for me too, is there's an actual chemical reaction happening. There's a physical and chemical thing happening with film that just isn't there with digital. And to me, it's a very, I think you used the word earlier, visceral. There's a visceral connection with it. And I'm so glad that we still celebrate this type of photography. I mean, I don't even know what I would do with a large format camera. I'd probably just, you know, worship it a little bit, maybe build a little altar around it. But it, to me, it's incredible. And I love that we still have people who are photographing the wild parts of Florida, the natural parts of Florida, who are doing it with that level of thought. And my God, the expense. How much does it cost you to make a print? Do you mind sharing that? Because I'm not even talking about your training, your education, or all that. What's the cost of processing something like that?
There's a lot of factors to this. I can tell you one of the ways that I calculate it is, for instance, if just about any time I go to photograph a landscape, I have with the wet plate process, I have to have my dark room nearby. So if I am canoeing down a river, it's in the canoe with us, along with all the chemistry. And along with all of the equipment, it's something that I, when I get to a location, I have to set all of that up. So, I may be spending 20 to 40 minutes setting up my equipment, getting the silver bath ready, getting my plates ready. And then I may take, 3 or 4 photographs to, you know, in the course of that time. Each photograph that I take has to be made within about 10 to 15 minutes. So the process, as I've said, it's called wet plate process, which means that the photographic plate that I'm using has to remain wet through the entire thing. And these are in-camera exposures. So the finished plate, the plate that I pull out of the camera and the plate that I develop and fix, that's it. There is no print. It is no negative. When I'm shooting on aluminum, it is a direct impression of what came through that lens. So you're 100% right about there being something in the chemistry and in this chemical reaction that's happening. When I pour the developer on a plate and put it in the fixer, everything that for one was not a light sensitive silver salt, everything that basically did not get converted, exposed to light, is pulled out of the image. So what you're left with is just metallic silver that's suspended on top of this plate, either a plate of aluminum or a plate of glass. It amazes me every single time I see a plate come out of the fixer, just to see the level of depth and detail that you get, and all you're looking at is metallic silver. You can zoom in, you know, as close as you can on these scans, and you won't see any blocky pixelation, or you won't see any degradation of the image. You're gonna just see silver.
that's gonna be highly desirable in about 75 years. People are going to be trying to recreate that vintage pixelation. It'll be, it's going to be a thing.
There'll be an app for that.
Make it 2025. That'll be what it's called. Rick, I'm sorry. I kind of hijacked your guest here, man.
Well, I want to understand. So it goes through the lens, mm-hmm. and it goes straight to either a piece of glass or a piece of metal. And it's a positive. You're not making a negative, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So, you know, one of my favorite photographers who did Silver Springs and Ocala was Jackson, William Henry Jackson. Did he shoot on glass?
So, yes. So, traditionally, the photographs that were being made on metal at that time, it would have been a thin sheet of metal that was coated with asphaltum. Those were typically, they were called ferrotypes or tin types.
Okay.
And just any cheap sheet of metal. That was really, you know, in the time frame that it first came out, it took a long time for it to be considered as actually a photographic process because of how commercial it was the photographer that came into town and set up a tent and took your family photograph and then moved on. most of the large scale photographs, like for instance, Carlton Watkins, who photographed the Yosemite area with 20 inch by 20 inch glass plates, Edward Curtis, a lot of the photographers Jackson used glass plates. And they would make glass negatives. And that's something that I can and I do make with these as well. It's just it's a slightly different process. My developer is usually different that I use when I'm developing those plates. But they would typically make a glass negative. And then from that, they would make albumen prints or platinum prints. Orotones were a common, Edward Curtis, I believe, as well.
And that's paper, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Because one of the things that's really distinctive, I have some, you know, old family tintypes, is that there's really no white. You know, it's the ground itself is kind of a gray, which gives it a completely different look.
It does. Yeah. And it's very, you know, tintypes, you can control so many elements of the tone of the image through, for instance, what chemistry I have in the developer, the strength of my fixer that I'm using, or even the particular chemistry of the fixer that you're using. All of that can impose different tones. So if I wanted a white highlight that was more of a silvery blue, I could adjust my developer to account for that. Or if I was looking for a more of like a coffee and cream type of tone, you can adapt your fixer as well.
Interesting.
And other chemistry. So there is. It's I spend more time with this process in maintaining my chemistry and in kind of perfecting, because every single plate I make is hand poured. I hand pour the collodion onto the plate, either plate of aluminum or plate of glass. I hand pour the developer. I hand pour the varnish, and I mix all of that. So I've worked on determining and finding what recipes and what chemistry gives me those tones that I really am drawn to with this process.
Do you have a shop in St. Augustine?
I do. I have a studio, a portrait studio. And so I buy appointments because I do still work for the school district. I bring people in here. And honestly, it's been amazing and rewarding. I opened the studio in January and I've been here now for 9 months. Before that, for about the last 3 years, I would, and I still do, I attend art markets and pop-ups, and I do quick tintype portraits, usually a 10 to 15 minute session when I do those events. But since I've been able to open up the studio here, I have had an opportunity to really get to see the intentionality that people bring to these sessions, because they understand that it is different and that it's not a digital photography session where you're going to come away with, you know, 40 to 80 potentially images for a particular show. So when they come in here, I've had people who come in to commemorate certain things, if either getting engaged or a wedding or their children as they grow. It's amazing to me, the people who have come back every year just to get a portrait of their children. People kind of recognize that these photographs have the ability to last. It's just so special to be able to hand someone something that they are going to hold on to for, who knows how long. These photographs have lasted more than 100 years. I don't expect to be around here to honor a guarantee policy, but I use the same recipes and the same exact process that they used in the 19th century. So I try to deliver a product that, you know, a photograph that's going to last as long as the photographs that they were able to make then.
It's interesting because the 10 types that I have, we have no idea who they are. So the images have lasted longer than the memories of these people, which is kind of made them, you know, immortal in a way, because I have no idea, you know, who they are, which kind of could be fun. But so they kind of, when you do a session, people come out with a piece of metal, right?
Exactly.
Basically. And then that's so cool.
And if they're interested in glass, I also shoot on glass. The reason that glass plates, you tend to see them more associated with, you know, larger fine art and works of art, or with glass negatives, glass is much more fragile. You know, back in the time period when this was being used, the sheet metal they were using was even cheaper, was even thinner than the aluminum that I use today. So it was about the thickness of a Coke can. So people could fold the photographs, you know, and put them in their pocket. They could keep them in a book. So there was just a level of durability with it that that has kind of allowed these photos. And speaking to, you know, holding on to photographs that you may not know who they are, there is something to these that with the people that come in, they often will either recognize family members in the photograph because of the different tone and the different sensitivity of this process. And so it's very neat. It's, I could go on and on about it for a very long time, but tintypes, the wet plate collodion process, it's not sensitive to light the way that film cameras are sensitive to light or the way that digital cameras have been programmed to receive a certain, you know, light. These are sensitive to the UV spectrum of light. So what that means is that yellows, oranges, and reds tend to photograph really dark. Blues and purples and violets tend to be brighter colors. And so oftentimes with people, certain things will come out in the photographs, either freckling, you know, more freckles you may see, or sometimes certain, you know, tattoos will expose very lightly, almost not even at all, where where the ink comes out very faint. So it's just a different photograph from what people are used to seeing. It's also a mirrored image. Since the photograph is coming straight through the lens right onto the plate, the plate is reversed from what you would expect to see. So for a lot of people, it is akin to seeing yourself in a mirror. It's the same sort of way that you see yourself when you look into a mirror. So it's just, there's a lot of little things about it that are very unique to this type of photography. And I love them all. I do.
So how long do you have to stay still for? Because you have to be perfectly still, right? Or you'll be blurry.
Yeah. So if I'm using natural light, continuous light, say set up near a window or outside, an exposure can be as short as a second, but on average, a continuous light exposure will be probably about 3 to 9 seconds.
Okay. So it's not like you're staying still for minutes.
It's not terribly long. I have had portraits that have been as long as 16 to 20 seconds where you have to stay still. And what historically they would use would be a head brace. So you'd have a piece of cast iron behind the chair or, you know, if you were standing, and that would basically be something that you could lean against and keep yourself steady for the whole portrait. Or oftentimes you see kids leaning against a tree, or, you know, they're standing against a table, holding the table. When I, in my studio, I use strobe lights, and I use a good amount of light. So the photograph is almost instantaneous.
Okay.
So you don't have to stay as still for as long. The thing with these cameras is that they have a very shallow depth of field, which means that things will blur very quickly, either in front of or behind wherever you want the image to be focused at. So when I'm taking a portrait or even a landscape, if it's windy and I'm taking a landscape, there could be some movement in the leaves. I account for that by either doing very long exposures and really stopping the lens down so that I may take a 7 to 10 minute exposure, or if I can, doing quicker exposures.
How does this all work when you're on the water, though? I mean, you're talking about some of that because you're not talking about a small little camera.
Yeah, it is a ton of equipment. You know, my kind of full-time experience doing video production, I'm used to carrying a lot of gear around. So it wasn't too much more for me. But I, in addition to whatever I happen to have for backpacking or paddling, I have to have a dark room, a tripod, the camera. I have to have all my chemistry. I have to have trays. I have to have a container for keeping the finished plates.
Now, those don't all go on a kayak with you.
They do. Yeah, typically a canoe.
Wow, the potential for loss.
Yeah, it's, I've paddled. I have paddled a little over 4,500 miles, so I try to keep the boat upright as often as I can.
Do you have like an otter box or something where they can, you know, stay dry, like a dry box?
The whole
box?
Thing would have to be in an otter box. Just put the whole damn canoe in the otter box, Rick.
Yeah. What I tend to use are giant dry bags. So I'll put everything in big dry bags, and then I have smaller cases. Yeah, they're like heavy duty plastic cases that I'll keep things in. But I've learned mostly through experience to reduce my unnecessary equipment as much as possible. So
yeah, things like water. You don't need that.
I'll now maybe bring one lens instead of, you know, three different possible options. Water is actually one of the most interesting things to me, particularly with this exhibit that I'm opening up. Water is an absolutely essential part of this process. I need to wash the plate for a minimum of 30 minutes in running water, just to remove the excess chemistry from the image. What I actually have done with a lot of the riverscapes particularly is I'll use local water for washing my plates and that. I've even used some of the water from the rivers and making my fixer and making the developer. So
how does nitrates, how do the fertilizer byproducts affect that? It's okay.
So I keep all the wastewater. I pack all that out with me.
No. I meant I wasn't asking that.
Like tannins and all the stuff
right.
in the water.
I'm thinking,
algae.
You know, if you're going through somewhere where there's a lot of fertilizer used, there's going to be a lot of phosphorus and
nitrate and nitrogen and stuff.
Nitrogen. How does that affect it?
100%. I hope for that, honestly, in the photos. I feel like there's something to the fact that the photograph was made using the water that these places came from. And I feel like if there is an influence to that, it'll come through. I filter a lot of things. So, you know, when I take water from, for instance, I was photographing earlier this year on the Econ Lacachi in Central Florida that empties out into the St. John's River. It was a low water event, and it was one of our, you know, it was towards the beginning of summer when we'd been having some really, really hot days. So there was a advisory not to swim, you know, in the water. And I made some plates over the course of 3 days on the Econ, and I'd filter all of the water through a filtration system and then use it for the chemistry. And I think it's kind of, you know, if there is a imperfection that is built into the chemistry or that's imparted in the chemistry from the conditions that we are living in, I think that's important to capture too. the lasting nature of these photographs. To me, it is a it's an object of record. It's something that, potentially people could look at in the future and gain some sort of, an idea of what of how we saw the world.
Wow. I love that idea. So how did your econ stuff turn out? I love the econ. And when it's dry, there are, I used to go back, was it last year? We found this spot that's normally underwater. And we went back several weeks in a row just because it was so beautiful when it wasn't covered with water, and all these wonderful wildflowers would emerge that you had no idea because they're underwater. And I just, it's kind of, there's some magical spots, honestly.
The Econ has become one of my favorite rivers in the state. It's a short, it's a relatively short river to paddle, and the way the habitat changes as you go out into the St. John's is just it's spectacular to do that by canoe or kayak. I did a solo paddle, and I made about, I believe, 7 plates over the course of 3 days. My third day, unfortunately, it got extremely windy as I was getting out into the St. John's, and paddling that canoe with more than 100 pounds of camera equipment and my camping equipment, solo. I didn't have a whole lot of opportunities on the last day to take pictures. That's kind of the experience, though, with doing these trips. It was a very, very beautiful river to set up at. I am gonna go back and try to get some more photographs, make some more plates of the palm tree islands and the really lower stretch of the Econ. But one of the plates from that trip will be at the Leitner Museum in this gallery.
So what other places are you going to show in the Leitner exhibit?
So there's a whole kind of body of work I've done on the Ocklawaha River, and so I'll have multiple plates from various locations on the river, a lot of different historic steamboat landings,
Oh.
as well as the earliest construction project in the 1930s with the historic ship canal, and then there's going to be some work from the Tossahatchie on the St. John's River as well. I have a few nature studies in there, and then there will be some work from the Payne's Prairie area as well, and then again from the Okefenokee.
I'm excited to see it. Unfortunately, your opening is the same day I'm speaking to Green Cove Springs, or I'd love to be there, but maybe I'll try and swing by the next day and see it.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, definitely reach out. It's going to be really exciting to have the exhibit open. And fortunately, I'm in St. Augustine, so I'm looking forward to spending time there at the Leitner and being able to share kind of, the unique and special nature of this type of photography with people.
I think I love what the Leitner is doing these days. It seems, when I was a kid, it was kind of a dusty, it was a museum of collections, basically, and, peeling paint. And then when I got on this kind of journey where I am now with hydrotherapy and taking the waters, I loved it because they have all that stuff still in there. But at some point, it seems like they shifted and they started bringing in these remarkable exhibits and putting them up. That room that kind of overlooks where the swimming pool used to be. And I've been to a couple exhibits through, first the Downton Abbey one, which was really fun. And then there was one, I think, on Art Nouveau that was outstanding. Is that
Yep.
the space you're going to be in?
So I'll be in the East Gallery, which is where they tend to hold their Leitner Local Series. So there was just a fantastic exhibit with Lenny Foster, who's a photographer, and he had it's the Magnolia Seasons, and it was an exhibit of his collection of photography, and so throughout the year they have three artists that are able to set up in that space, and they're all Florida-based artists.
Oh,
So
cool.
Yeah, it's I've really been fortunate to have an excellent relationship with the Leitner. I've done some pop-up markets there where I've done the portraiture, the tintypes, and to me, just to have an opportunity to use this process and take photos on the spot of people in a way that probably hasn't been done in that building in 100 years, you know. It was very, very cool. It's a Gilded Age hotel, so it was in its heyday when this process was in its heyday. I'm really grateful to have the support from them with this exhibit.
I'm just curious, if you use the Leitner water, does it smell like sulfur?
Oh my goodness.
Because it did.
You're on a St. Augustine kick.
No. Yeah, I am. I'm always on a St. Augustine kick. But if you go, they have those ponds, in the courtyard, you could smell the sulfur. And, so when Henry Flagler was building his hotel across the street, he kept getting sulfur water, and he didn't want sulfur water. And he kept drilling deeper and deeper and deeper, and eventually, I think he just threw in the towel. But the water there is really stinky.
Yeah.
Aromatic is the phrase we use. Thank you.
Long living.
I have a question. I know we're at the end of our time. What pointed you towards the subject matter?
I have kind of grown up taking photographs, and I moved into the video world, and through all of that, the thing that has always I've always been drawn towards are nature scenes and nature studies. To me, it's an opportunity to share with people who might not be able to experience those things, or who may, have a set of circumstances in which they just struggle to get out into places of nature. I think it's very it's to me, it's some of the most beautiful things I could point a camera at. And growing up, it's always been just a time of relaxation for me. When I first started getting back into photography, that was where I wanted to go. I wanted to take photographs of landscapes. I wanted to particularly showcase Florida. And the more I learned about the history of this process, particularly the early photographers, like Carlton Watkins, and how they were taking these expeditions, something that I equally love, going back into the back country with everything that you need, and just experiencing places where our presence isn't the kind of loudest presence in the environment. I was just enchanted with them being able to go into those places and take these technically precise and beautiful images, and to take those plates and bring them to Washington to be able to push legislators for conservation for some of our earliest conservation areas. That's a legacy that, if I can do just a small part of being able to show people these spaces that are changing through development, changing through climate change, if I can have an opportunity to show people these places and give them just a minute or so to pause and enjoy them, think about them, feel concern for them. Any of those, that's to me just being able to keep that, keep the legacy of this process going.
That's so incredible. That was years ago, probably 7 years, not that many years ago. I interviewed Carlton Ward, and I asked him why Florida? Like, why is this where you want to put your resources and your talent? And he said, I think he was already on assignment for it was either National Geographic or an outfit similar to it. And he said every time he got on a plane and came home, he saw more and more of Florida that he loved and knew falling under the weight of development. And he just thought, well, why am I traveling the world to protect these places when I can protect what's right here? And I don't know, I'm sure there are other places in the United States where it moves people this way, but it's interesting to me that it's almost like a almost like artistic holy orders. You know, you talk about it's like a calling that you feel like you have to do this.
It's Carlton's work is amazing, both, you know, photography and video. And it is very true. That, you know, in 2008, my wife and I began a 7-month trip, 1,500-mile paddle around the state of Florida, followed by 1,300 miles hiking through the state of Florida. There's 2,800 miles total. And the reason that I wanted to do that trip was, having grown up in the state, having the opportunity to see that change, see development along the coast and go through kind of the center part of the state and see all these places that people were from throughout the state that I had no idea were there, and to see what places were protected and what places were unlike anywhere else that you can find in, you know, outside of the Southeast. We have some just absolutely amazing and wild places still, in spite of the development that we've had, and in spite of the water use, there's still so much that you can go out and see here that I feel we need to just keep reminding people.
It's definitely, once you experience wild Florida, I don't think you can unexperience it. I don't think you can turn a blind eye to it. If you really know what you're seeing, I think it changes people. And I like that. I like that about the state. You know, we leave our mark on you, whether you want us to or not.
This week's t-shirt.
Yep. Florida will brand you, man. It'll get you. So I want to point out, for everybody who's not going to have a chance to check the show notes, because I know as much as I put time and thought into writing these as we record, I never check the show notes on anything I listen to unless it's something I really, really, really want to know about. The show that we're referring to is at the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine. It's called Echoes of the Wild, and it opens October 3rd, 2025, and it runs through January 18th, 2026. So please make time to go see it. Matt, this has been wild, and we've gone way over time, but thank you for sharing part of your day with us. I'm sure after spending your day dealing with school students and school-age kids, you wanted nothing more than to switch gears immediately and talk about silver and aluminum and colloidal, or how did you pronounce that?
I use a photographic collodion.
Collodion. Yeah, you wanted to use all those big words with
that
us.
That word is not part of my vocabulary.
Collodion. Anyway, thank you so much. I don't have plans to go out to St. Augustine, but I do now. I actually have my hotels.com page pulled up to see if there's any chance to get out there before the show ends. And
get out there before the lights go up, because it gets nuts.
No, the lights aren't bad. I think they're pretty, but I'm not going to get out.
I love them.
There's no way I can get. I've got so much going on before Thanksgiving that I don't see how I get out there sooner. If only it were closer.
The week between Christmas and Thanksgiving is good a lot of times, because a lot of
the week
be
between Christmas and Thanksgiving.
I'm sorry, Christmas and New Year's. Between Christmas and New Year's. A lot of time they used to say in Orlando that was the best time to go to Disney, because everybody wants to be at home at that time. But I don't know if that's still the case.
I'm actually going to be camping that week. So I'll work it out. I'll get there. I love St. Augustine. I love photography. I love a road trip. You know, it's the perfect storm. Anyway, Matt, thank you.
Thank you for inspiring us.
Yes, Rick's going to go out and buy a large format camera.
No, I'm not. I still love digital. You know, when we, back in the film days, you know, I'd take roll after roll after roll and maybe get one shot for five rolls and spend a ton of money on development.
No,
now
no,
it's like,
yeah,
I have like 30,000 photos on my camera.
Well, so don't go buy a large format camera.
No.
Have you gotten any interesting packages in the mail, Rick?
I got stickers from our friend over in Levy County.
All right. Well, there's an interesting package heading your way. And
okay,
if Julie asks, it did not come from me.
Okay.
So with that, I want to just, before we thank our listeners, I want to say, if you're listening to this fairly close to when it was recorded, which is September 2025, I am going to be at the Oviedo Mall Page and Pen Festival on Saturday, October 4th. Please, please, please come out and see me. It's for readers. It's for writers. I'm actually giving a talk, How Not to Starve as a Writer. If you've always wanted to know how to set up your own writer's OnlyFans, I'll be delving into that. I'm kidding. I'm not going to do that.
Well, you know, that's a haunted mall, right?
It is a haunted mall. So there's always that. If you're on Threads and you follow Oviedo Mall, you know they're haunted, but I'll be out there. Don't shout out to things I'm doing much because these are evergreen podcasts, but I feel like this is the first year for the festival and I want to see it succeed. And the marketing director for Oviedo Mall was on the podcast and that's how I even found out about it. So on your way out to see Matt Keene's photography at the Lightner, stop by the Oviedo Mall in Orlando on October 4th. So there's that. And at long last, we want to thank our paid supporters. New supporter-ish, Bill Grable, Stephanie Hewley, Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, Bet's Boys Adventure, Elise Smith. Last week, I pronounced her name Elsie, or 2 weeks ago. And I feel so bad because she sent me a message on Instagram. She's like, FYI, just so you know, no big deal. But my name is Elise, not Elsie. And I was so embarrassed. And Elise, I'm so sorry. Carol Miller, I say her name right almost every week. Leslie Hallweg, Davida Breyer, Natalie Zachrick, Angela Connolly, John Bowen, and Ryan Worthington, as well as Sulcata Grove. Please consider supporting the podcast. It's super cheap. It's super fun. And we send you cool stuff. With that said, I think we're out of time and we will see you next episode on Florida Spectacular. Have a great week.
Adios.